happiness and distress. So in all situations, the mind has to imagine that there's pleasure or the possibility of pleasure. There has to be some notion in the mind that seems enjoyable. You'll find this true in everyone, in every situation. It's amazing what the mind can do, how much the mind can visualize and imagine. Perhaps you may remember being sick, very sick once, and just laying there in bed. But still, with your mind, you were imagining things to amuse yourself. You've ever been to India, gotten sick, and you're flat on your back. Hot sun and mosquitoes are biting you. What happened to you, man? So there you are, and you're just laying, you know, there's no comfortable bed or anything, you're just laying on a mat on the floor, and it's hot and muggy, and you're sick, and none of the Western conveniences is around, and some other you try to just relish some kind of nice mental attitude. Realize that mental enjoyment is actually all of the enjoyment that there is in this world. You enjoy it through the mind, whether it's romance, this activity, that activity, even work. You can enjoy work in that you don't like having to conform to somebody else's hours, but you do like feeling a sense that you're accomplishing something and you have abilities that you can demonstrate. And all this is a mental affair. You're relishing various mental currents, various mental waves. Just try catching yourself doing that. See how powerful the mind is. So, because the mind is so powerful and it can be attracted to material existence almost instantaneously, you will rightfully wonder that even if I take up the transcendental path, there's a good chance of failure. There's so much glitter out there in the world of illusion, what will become of me? My determination may get weak. So, it is for that reason that Arjuna is asking questions like this of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Of course, we should bear in mind that all the means for perfect success in one lifetime are given in Bhagavad Gita. Nevertheless, it's also true that some percentage of persons do misuse their independence and kind of get sick again after becoming cured. You all know that in the health field, in hospitals, some patients follow the doctor's instructions very nicely and they gradually get well. And other patients, they follow for a while, then they stop. Then they follow for a while, and they stop. They never really get it together. There are all types of patients in this world, speaking of physical. And also there are all kinds of patients in this world in terms of getting over the material disease completely. We're all individual. We have different levels of commitment and absorption and spiritual practice. Of course, we should desire to become firmly situated on the transcendental path, beyond the vicissitudes, beyond the changes of the body and mind. How do you do that? You must become aware of the spirit self, the activity, in fact, the very existence of the spirit self. That is so confidential. In one sense, when you say there's no self, it's like in Buddhism, anatta, no self, one says that's correct. There's no self like anybody knows about or you can see about. The activities of the real self are the most confidential spiritual knowledge. The qualities of the spiritual self are the most confidential. But in the beginning, to get people to just stop their craziness, we're going to talk to them. No self. Just stop acting your thing. It's like if you're spending your life banging your head against the wall. You won't stop. Someone says you. No need to bang your head against the wall. There's no self. And then you stop. Of course, the real solution is to find actually what you should do with your head. And that's what Bhagavad Gita is trying to instruct you. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita is beyond nirvana, or beyond the mere cessation of material. That's what makes Krishna consciousness sometimes a bit difficult for people to understand. Krishna consciousness actually involves things beyond liberation. Beyond the negative into the purely positive. Spiritual life means you're trying to give enjoyment. It's like a hand. When you're going to eat tonight, will the hand pick up the food and try to eat on its own? No. What does the hand do? It takes food and brings it to the mouth, the nourishment of the whole body. So we are living entities, and not the whole. Our constitutional nature is to assist in the pleasure of the whole. This is a radical and revolutionary difference. Therefore, even spiritual practices that are based consciously or unconsciously on the notion that I am the enjoyer can only be said to be very limited, because the real problem is thinking I am the enjoyer. It's such a problem that, for example, Buddha taught once that you don't exist, so don't worry about being enjoyer because you don't exist. Just to strike hard at this root problem of thinking I'm the enjoyer. In other words, you're so unintelligent, you can't hear about the positive activities of the pure spirit self, because you'll confuse it with materialism. Therefore, because you're not that intelligent, no self exists. Of course, the most intelligent thing is to understand the activities of the pure self and not confuse it with the activities of the material self. So we have to get the root cause of material existence. The root cause is thinking, I am the enjoyer. I should feel pleasure on my own, independent of Krishna. You understand? It's just as ridiculous as the hand picking up food and thinking, I will enjoy it. I will feel nourished by eating the food. So the hand brings it to the mouth, and then the whole body is nourished. So yes, ideally, in Krishna consciousness, you don't wake up in the morning and kind of turn on your bliss meter and test yourself. How do I feel this morning? I mean, I know in the beginning, you know, you like that, but gradually as you become purified, you start to think, how much pleasure can I give Krishna today? Thank you. sounds very nice in theory, but actually the whole art of spiritual practice is to make it not just theory, but actuality. Who is the enjoyer? This is the battlefield, the issue that we're really grappling with, and the one that causes us the problem. How can I be the enjoyer if I'm just a tiny part? I'm meant to bring pleasure to the whole. And automatically, without even worrying, then I'll be taken care of. But we don't have that confidence. So many verses we've been as independent, separate entities. For so many verses we've been trying to ferret out enjoyment for ourselves. There's some dog on the ferret, right? Ferrets things out, right? And we're like that. A long nose or a long mouth? Yeah, long nose. Ferrets. And we like that. We wake up in the morning and have a long nose and try to ferret out pleasure for the day. And we try to find other ferrets who will band together with us. Together we search for pleasure. You can catch yourself like that. You can become very self-disciplined. Well, let me ask you this, Terry. Do you ever ask yourself why you should be the enjoyer? Why not? Who told you you should be the enjoyer? Who gave you that idea? What gave you that idea? Why is it that way? Who told you that? Where did you get this notion from? You see what I'm getting at? Where did this notion come from? Well, you gotta find out. What do you say? Where does this notion come from that I am the enjoyer? I should be the enjoyer. Where's conditioning come from? You'll find it in also in other species of life. Although their capacity for choice is much more restricted still. Other species of life also have to work with it. Whether consciously or instinctively, whatever, still acting. Although in a very submerged, dull way.
Okay, but it's actually enjoyment or is it a connection with things? Thinking of like animals, food things which seem to be for enjoyment. Like dogs like to be in pasture and think they're human, but maybe it's to do with
but that's a human, yeah, just like humans. Dogs like to be petted, humans like to be petted. But it's sense gratification. Yeah?
Yeah, it's sense gratification.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also something about connecting with something.
Yes, yeah, you're right. That is sense gratification. Let me connect with something so I can feel pleasure, but you're not making the right connection.
No, that's what I mean. There's a subtle difference between the bit that feels pleasure and the bit that just feels a natural connection with another human being. Like somebody might put their hand on you. And you don't necessarily think, oh, that's a really wonderful sensation. but you can actually feel the other spirits that are inside that body.
You feel spirit. You cannot feel spirit physically. You'll feel another entity. You'll feel the physique of another entity. You can feel the physique. If you're more subtle, you can feel the mind of another entity, but through physical and mental methods, you cannot feel spirit. Although indirectly, you can feel its presence, but you cannot feel it directly. Physical and mental method. But that's also part of sense gratification, as you're saying. You want to feel that you exist by knowing others exist and recognize that you exist.
Okay.
Reassurance.
That's what you call sense gratification.
That's all part of it. It's subtle, though. That's more subtle.
Right.
You feel like you're belonging to the human race, belonging to a family, belonging to someone, belonging to the universe. All subtle sense gratification. But what is the real connection you should be making?
Well, I know the answer.
That's why yoga actually means to connect, to link up.
I can speak that up again. Is that a problem?
Any other questions about this? That's why you need to understand there are different influences, different energies operating in this universe, and you can take your pick which one of the energies you want to associate with. Therefore, mind, in association with industry energy, becomes filled with thoughts of I should enjoy, I enjoy it. And mind, in connection with spiritual energy, becomes infused with thinking, I should give pleasure to the supreme enjoyer. So there are methods, for example, of meditation that will, if not stop temporarily, at least diminish your attempts to be the enjoyer. But the only permanent solution is not so much one of desisting, but of one of engaging in your natural constitutional position. So it's very nice, for example, to become aware of how your body is functioning. You can sit very still and feel how your body is functioning. And then, as you become more advanced, you can feel how your mind is functioning. You can see your emotions. So in that way you're becoming aware of how all your excess baggage is acting. But that activity of just watching and becoming aware of your physiological emotional state, that's not your original nature. You certainly are aware of your conditioning. But what about the root conditioning of which you think you are the enjoyer? But even through meditation, you can still try to be the enjoyer. Of course, some people would say, well, you sound like a killjoy. What's wrong with enjoying? The wrong is that it's actually not enjoyment, and that by trying to be the enjoyer, you cancel out your real happiness. Because real happiness comes from recognition of your constitutional position as being enjoyed. That's the resolution. You are the enjoyed. That means that you are energy and you're meant to be enjoyed by the energetic source. Yes! Are you grasping why this is such a radical revolutionary shift? It's a bit inconceivable. How can you not be the enjoyer? I mean, come on, I'm serious. The whole world turns on this illusion that we are the enjoyers. And you even, for example, in the beginning you'll turn to Bhagavad Gita, hoping that you'll enjoy. I read some of the other books in Christ the other day. This book will help you to enjoy it. Nice reading, you'll enjoy it. As you're reading it, thinking you're going to enjoy it, you find your consciousness shifting. So to deal with Bhagavad Gita means to dare let the thought come into your intelligence. I'm not the enjoyer. Real life is something else. That's why Krishna spoke to Bhagavad Gita on a battlefield. Where's the enjoyment? And that was Arjuna's question, his argument to Krishna in the beginning. Krishna, what pleasure can come out of this path? What good fortune can come out of it? He's bringing up the position of the enjoyer. And Krishna just told him, fight and think of me. Victory and defeat is not your concern. You can just be an instrument as well. Just play the part that the whole ordains. Now you see why Bhagavad Gita is such a radical book. It's bringing about a total shift of consciousness. It's telling you, dare you think that you're not going to enjoy it? Can you do it? Dare you think that you're meant to be enjoyed? Just like the hand brings food to the mouth and the whole body is nourished. Living entity is meant to bring pleasure to Krishna and the people. That sounds so far away from our existential condition right now, in which this I want to be happy, I want to be pleasure, I want to be pleased. This bug is just fighting us all the time. What's in it for me? What's in it for me? And that's what Arjuna was arguing with Krishna about in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, what's in it for me, this battle? So, are we all starting to grasp that? It's a very revolutionary point. And it takes a lot of... This is why we have spiritual practices. Because we must actually experience this, not just say it in theory. Oh yes, we are all part of the great one. We are all connected. Holism is everything. Let's be holistic. No more fragmentation. We don't talk that stuff, but how do you act in that way? In every moment of the day. That is Krishna. How the part and the whole act in such a way that perfection is made obvious to the part. Perfection is always obvious to the whole. But the part obvious. We have this feverish disease in which we can try and enjoy it. The quicker you can kick this, the better. Like at a young age, you can really start dealing with this point. You're capable of doing so much good for the world. So neat that you can wait till you're older and you smash your head this way and that way. You can do the greatest good for yourself and others by just trying to simulate this point and master everyday life. Although, there's so much social pressure. Enjoy. You go out and get your happiness. Your senses. Reach out for the sense objects. It's normal. That's natural. Get for you. Acquire. Grapple. Grope. That is life. If you ever think about what you're trying to acquire and grapple and grope is temporary and decaying in front of your eyes, like grabbing smoke. Next time you have a campfire, sit around the campfire and try to grab the smoke. You go on like an all-night walk. can't grab this book. And what's the only result? You get a cramped arm. And that's what happens in material existence. People try grabbing smoke. Ephemeral, phantasmagoric material happiness. Try different styles of gravity. Thinking that's going to change the situation. Each time they open their hand, you can't grab smoke. And you find their arms stay here. So people, they die weary. Actually, they don't show it a lot of times, especially in Western countries, because they're so loud. They don't even let their children know that it's all futile. It's good to understand what we're up against so we can understand Krishna's points about unsuccessful transcendentalism, because this is the battle that transcendentalists are doing.
Henry Bax, talk a little more about the alt-ego and what it does to this in the mind. This is what we are talking about. Another secret
that activity that gives the supreme whole pleasure, concurrently, simultaneously, going to give part pleasure too. You don't see it that way, right? I really enjoy Bhagavad Gita. What's actually going on is, you studying Bhagavad Gita gives Krishna pleasure, therefore automatically the part gives pleasure. Because you're not yet conscious of all that's going on. All you know is, I have a little tiny part. Imagine myself to be separate. I enjoy Bhagavad Gita. You can't see the whole system. Fascinating, isn't it?
Arjuna said, O Krishna, what is the destination of the unsuccessful transcendentalist who, in the beginning, takes the process of self-realization with faith, but who later desists due to the worldly mindedness and thus does not attain perfection in mysticism?
Yes, I mean, you might say that yourself in this verse, yes, in the beginning. And taking the process of self-realization with faith. But later, I may desist due to worldly mindedness. What will happen to me? So the purport, we find some information. First of all, what is the basic principle of self-realization? It's like we had one young man here yesterday. Well, he's from England too, isn't he? And he was very sensitive and appeared very sensitive at the time. He had some hazy ideas of spiritual love and compassion. So I tried to explain to him very firmly. Get out of the sky and just try to understand what are the basic principles of spiritual science. First of all, you're not the body. You're different from the body. And your happiness does not lie in the body or the mind. These things we have to grasp as the fundamental building blocks of spiritual science. And that takes it right out of the clouds. So I had to repeat it again and again. And I wasn't surprised I had to repeat it because people just think the more you define something, the less spiritual it is. Define something is, the more automatically spiritual it is. And the more you define or talk about something, then the more material it is. That sentiment is there. Of course, unconsciously they use that notion as a defense of their sense verification. Because if you really define very specifically, are you the body or are you not, it naturally causes you to rearrange all your activities. If you're not the body, then why are you acting for sense gratification? And to learn how to see this driving for sense gratification in all our affairs, even subtle, that's a great art, a great science. In other words, we think we're being innocent. So much of the day, right? We were not. We're trying to take pleasure. So Bhagavad Gita will arm you with the required wisdom to see what you're doing throughout the day. So real insight meditation begins with understanding what your sensory apparatus and mind is doing during the day. That's just the beginning. Then you've got to make a solid step from false engagement by the false self to real engagement by the real self. That is Krishna consciousness. Otherwise, just watch the movements of your body and mind. That'll give you, of course, knowledge, but not the highest knowledge, because you're not the body or the mind. Certainly, it is better to watch the movements of your body and mind than go around doing so much karmic activity. But unless you're actually situated in positive spiritual activity, you won't be able to simply just watch the movements of your body and mind year after year. You need positive engagement, positive absorption. First of all, remember the basics of spiritual science. I am different from the body. And my happiness is not bound up in the body. Now at the bottom of the page, 7 lines up from the bottom, we find this statement by Srila Prabhupada. To pursue the transcendental path is more or less to declare war on the illusory energy. Consequently, whenever a person tries to escape the clutches of this illusory energy, she tries to defeat the practitioner by various allurements. They say, why is the Krishna energy called she? And actually, all energies are she. In other words, in terms of the Vedic spiritual text, he and she is not, in its major sense, applied to what we call male and female. In the Vedic, viewpoint, he and she applies to energy and the energetic. Enjoyer and enjoy. So in that sense, all energies are female, and only the energetic source is male. That's the real understanding of masculine and feminine being so. Therefore, if there is an illusory energy, just like there is an energy living energies, they are an energy, there is an energy illusion too. All are she. There's only one male as the energetic source. In that sense, you don't find any males in the ordinary event. So I usually just since the illusory energy is declaring war, anybody trying to get out of his clutches. You feel that sometimes? There's different alarms for each of us. Who knows? All day, daydream. once again, we're getting up back to a hope standard. You see, we have to expand our understanding of what he's doing is beyond even Western conception. To feel that others are dependent on us, to feel that we have a role to play, an essential role to play for us. In the Vedic terminology, that's also grouped under enjoyment. Although Western civilization is hard to see that. Therefore, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he is the supreme enjoyer, he is the supreme friend, and he is the supreme controller. But illusory life means we try to be those three things. We try to be everyone's friend, we try to be the controller, and we try to be the enjoyer.
So in other words, in this world we find that everyone's duty bound, perhaps
but they don't know what the number one duty is. Everyone wants to be responsible, but they don't know what the real responsibility is. So Krishna consciousness is not against responsibility, it's a recognition of the real responsibility. Therefore, a Krishna conscious person appears to be maybe carefree, but no, they are very careful about the real motivation. Yes. Another perfect question. You know, Arjuna's questions are so salient. They're so perfect. He's doing that service on behalf of us. He's, for our education, he's undergoing an experience as if he's an illusion and responding in that way. So we can see, since we've got a classic example of what it's like, so Arjuna's asking. But it seems to me that you give up your yoga, you give up your transcendental endeavors, you'll fail both ways. It'll be a spiritual failure and a material failure. Because in order to take up activities of reality, you have to give up the illusion. But then you give up the activities of reality, and you also give it up, you lose your material activities, you've lost on all fronts. That's a good question, doesn't it? So what is the answer? First of all, even someone who thinks he or she is materially successful is losing, because any material gain will be lost. Secondly, get on the bus. You pay your fare and you sit down. Similarly, at the time of death, you pay your fare with whatever you've accumulated in this life. You leave it with the bus driver and you go sit down and go to another body. So whatever you've accumulated, skills, wealth, hobbies, they're just fare to your next body. You leave it behind in the collection box and sit down in transit to another body. What that body is, you don't know. So in that sense, everybody's losing materially. Still, Arjuna is asking, it seems, if the aspiring transcendentalist fails, then he apparently loses both ways. In other words, he can enjoy neither material happiness nor spiritual success. To really answer this question, you've got to know there's no such thing as material happiness. Therefore, only in apparent terms is this an actual, two-sided presentation. Spiritual and material success, it seems I'll lose both. Both hands are full. Spiritual success, material success, I'll lose both. No, this is actually. There's no material to it. But just for the sake of appearance, if I do it in that, lose both ways. There's no both ways. Material gain is imaginary. That's easy to understand when you remember the statement. I come into this world with nothing and I leave with nothing. And in between birth and death, I'm busy grabbing onto everything. I'm trying to squeeze the success out of it. Losing both ways. say there's actually only one way. And that's great. Who can answer this question? To answer such questions in our union, you have to be extraordinarily knowing. As he says here in text 39. Etande samsayam Krishna chetam ahasheshita svaranya samsayasyasya cheta na yukupajyate. This is my doubt, O Krishna, and I ask you to dispel it completely. But for you, no one is to be found who can destroy this doubt. Krishna is completely whole. Therefore, Krishna is entitled to answer this question. Krishna is qualified to answer this question. Giving you the overall view, because Krishna is the supreme overall. If you want to understand the system, you've got to go to the supreme system maker. You can't answer the question because you're part of the system. You're not aware of the whole system. You're just a bunch of the cog in the infinite existence. So first, Krishna responded in text 40. A partial answer. Shri Bhagavan Vasya. Partha Nadeha Navidva. The Supreme Personality God is saying, read the rest, Emma. Yes, any endeavor on the path of Krishna consciousness never meets with any inauspicious result. Even if you stop, that progress stays with you. If you only complete 1% of Krishna consciousness in this life, in your next life you start off from that point. You take your college credit, university credits with you. But not in material activities. You lose your credit. Even before death comes. You do not take your credit. You do take your mature reactions. But the actual wealth you've accumulated, knowledge you've accumulated, experience you with you, you don't take with you. That's the problem with theories that, well, I must have experienced that in a previous life. You don't take the experience with you, you take the reactions. You don't take your material experience with you. In the purport, after Krishna in the verse assures you that anything you do on a transcendental path will never result in auspicious. Therefore, take part in that. Even a little bit done is glorious. In other words, never fear that even partial spiritual progress is harmful. Go for it. Get as far as you can get. That's what Krishna's doing, encouraging you, cheering you on, exhorting on. Go for it. Get as far as you can get. Even if you think you're only going to get partial attainment, still go for it. Otherwise, what else do you have to do? So in the purport, we see a very famous verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, 1.5, Sri Narayana instructs the Vyasadeva as follows. Sattva sadamam chananam purjam hare
If someone gives up all material prospects and takes complete shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there is no loss or degradation in any way. On the other hand, a non-devotee may fully engage in his occupational duties and yet not gain anything. A material prospect...
Yes. So even if you're taking complete shelter of Krishna consciousness, your natural position, and you don't persist, still there's no loss. But if you fully and perfectly execute your material duties, you will not gain anything, you'll lose it. Even if you want to add things up in the pot and loss power, still Krishna's telling you, go for the transcendental, make even a partial attempt. Otherwise, even by your so-called, or even by your apparent full and proper engagement with your activities, you're still losing everything. Very good common sense presentation, yes?
Very good common sense presentation.
You want to look at things, you know, like a gambler, profit, loss, a businessman. Still, go all out for spiritual attainment. Even if you cannot persist, still you won't be the loser. But if you go all out for material success, and even if you do get it beyond your wildest expectations, you'll still be the loser. Whatever spiritual progress you made in Krishna consciousness, you'll never lose that. Now we get to the two categories of unsuccessful yogis, page 353. Rāpya punya kṛtāṁ lokān viṣitvā śāśvati samā śrutīnāṁ śīnakāṇye yoga vrṣṭo vajāyate. Yes. So, in the purport we see that the unsuccessful yogis are divided into two classes. One who has fallen after very little progress, one who has fallen after long practice of yoga. So for that, one who's fallen after short period practice, he goes to the higher planets, the planets of the devas, the demigods, where the material happiness is far beyond the earthly standard. Like the difference between Hawaii, living in Hawaii and living in North Korea. And after a spell in the heavenly planets, the higher planet system, you come back to Earth. Now you may ask, why did the unsuccessful yogi go to heavenly planets? Because from the material point of view, even transcendental activities are the best kind of good karma, although they're actually not good karma. They included within them are the effects of good karma. So the unsuccessful yogi, even though he's not trying to form good karma, he gets all the effects of good karma in his next life. So he goes to the higher planets, where generally you only go if you're performing good karma. And then, after a certain time, he falls back to Earth in a conducive situation for spiritual advancement. That means families of wealthy persons or families of righteous priests. Why the wealthy family? Because ideally you don't have to worry about your maintenance and you can just have so much free time for spiritual cultivation. And why a family of Brahmana priests? Well, that's obvious. Take birth in the family where parents are full-time engaged in studying and teaching spiritual rituals, provides a favorable atmosphere for spiritual development. Of course, there's danger too. The Prabhupada himself pointed out that. You can take birth in the family of the wealthy and just become overwhelmed by the wealth and forget your original purpose. Or you can take birth in a family of priests, Brahmanas, spiritual scholars, and just become absorbed in metaphysical knowledge without devotion. Just accumulating dry metaphysical understanding. Without getting to the point of it all. Therefore, the Prabhupada would just advise us, finish your business in this lifetime. Don't take a chance on another person. Next, in text 42, we go to the one who's fallen after a long period of practice, page 354. Atapa yoginam eva gure bhavati dhimatam eta dhimrila bhaktaram loke jama yadidrasam. Am I going to read that? Yes, so you may ask, what's the difference between this kind of birth and birth in the family of Brahmana teacher or priest? Well, Brahmana teacher or priest means still within the modes of incarnation, a mode of goodness, righteous. Whereas transcendentalist, a family transcendentalist, is beyond even goodness, righteousness. Beyond all the dualities of the world. That's the rarest birth in this world. So in the purport, Prabhupada is saying that he himself had the opportunity to take birth in such a man, as well as a spiritual master. That's the rarest birth. Take birth in a family of Bhagavad Gita practitioners, staunch practitioners of Bhagavad Gita. That's much more advantageous than taking birth in, say, a family of priests. Teaches us Vedic knowledge. Because, as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is the goal of the Vedas, the compiler of the Vedas. Not all the Vedas, Krishna is to be known. But Brahmana priests can just get caught up in, you know, the Ayurveda or astrology, the astrological Vedas, so Veda means knowledge. All the departments of human knowledge have their origin in the Veda. Like in World War II, the Germans were studying the Vedas for aeronautic information. That's where they got the swastika from. Westerners, they read the symbol swastika. Actually, the Veda symbol means auspiciousness. Germans appropriated. Any questions so far?
On taking such a birth, he revives the divine consciousness of his previous life, and he again tries to make further progress in order to achieve complete success.
Yes, your divine consciousness of your previous life is not lost, whatever efforts you made. That's where you start off from. Whereas whatever material activities you did, whatever is lost, the results are lost. No credit. the next verse, 44. Urvaja Sainte Naiva, Vite Shogisa, Jigasa Rapido Vestia, Shabda Brahma Tivartende. Let's read this one again. Yes, a real, pure Bhagavad Christian consciousness beyond the rituals of religion. In other words, what do we need? Not enough ritual, religious ritualism, or religious righteousness, piety, good karma. All of these things are striving for, but the conclusion is driving far beyond them. And to provoke that controversy, Krishna is speaking of the battlefield, pretty much in a fight. And that's a challenge to all those attached to piety and material righteousness. How can the other unit be sacred focus on a battlefield who's fighting one another? So if you have to understand that, you have to know. The battlefield is composed of energies. Whose energies are they? One who knows that is beyond piety and material goodness. Next 45. But yet not yet the man is true, yogi samsara kilvisa, aneka dharma samsara, shatavyati param yatin. Yes. Doesn't have to be many, many verses like this. That's the advantage of the Hare Krishna mantra and devotional service, bhakti yoga. You can finish it in one night, even if you have no previous thought. But in dealing with the other systems of yoga, it can take many verses. Dhyana yoga, yoga requiring metaphysical knowledge. Or mystic yoga, in terms of acquiring yogic powers, mystic abilities. All these things are meant to culminate in bhakti, the original activity of living energy, of rendering love and devotion to the whole of Krishna, to all travel for our pleasure. Sooner or later, you have to come to that. You can either do it directly or indirectly. If you do it indirectly, it takes many verses. Because this whole point of realizing I am meant to give pleasure to Krishna is so revolutionary that you may take many verses coming to it in an indirect way. I will study medicine knowledge, that way I will attain perfection. I will practice yogic powers, that way I will attain perfection. I will perform activities of righteousness, good karma, that way I will attain perfection. In all these endeavors is still the illusion. I am the enjoyer, I am the doer. As soon as you take up bhakti yoga, the yoga of love and devotion, then the conundrum hits you right through the eyes. Who is the enjoyer? Whose pleasure am I doing things for? That's why even a simple, innocent, naive practitioner of Krishna consciousness is more advanced than the greatest mystic yogi or metaphysical knower. I think. Yeah. All right. If any questions, we close. Do it. You just stack as the maintainer, I am the controller. It depends on me. Just to smash that conception, Buddha gave partial proof. You don't exist. To knock you off your false plateaus. You don't exist. Remember, what's the question of you maintaining or controlling or enjoying? In the partial sense, that's correct. The false you does not exist. But what is the real you that exists? That you find out. And that your real identity is beyond the range of your ordinary sense perception. By engaging in the positive activities of your ocean service, you'll start to get an affinity in the existence of your real self. Go for it. So those of you whose lives are being dedicated to me, that's my Christian service. Thank you. It's